everybody. Welcome back to another exciting episode of Indie Film Cafe. I'm your host, Jonathan Moody, and I've got two amazing guests here. One's been here a few times already. Please welcome John Ward. How you doing, John?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you for asking. And we also got Cameron Scott for the first time. How are you doing, Cameron?
I'm doing great. I'm amazing today. Feeling good.
Now we got Cameron. I got Cameron because he's got his own little podcast that a lot of it talks about full moon movies. So mm-hmm. I thought, well, what better way to like bring him onto the show for the first time with introducing him into the realm of full moon films, which technically is part full moon, part Tempe in my mind, because I think I remember buying the DVD on the Tempe DVD. You know, right? If I'm correct.
Yep.
Okay.
It's that weird place with Full Moon. Yeah, it was that weird place where Full Moon was going from film to digital, and they brought in Tempe.
Yeah, definitely. So the movie that we're going to be watching, or not watching, we've already watched, but the movie that we're going to be talking about is Witch House 3. But before we get into this, let's listen to some mood music. All right, we are back. So we all watched separately Witch House 3, and I believe all three of us have seen this movie at least more than once, right?
Like, oh yeah, a couple times. I own it.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so Cameron, first off, what was your like initial response when you first watched it, as opposed to like nowadays when you're watching it?
No, I remember seeing this back in the day because I've always been a Full Moon fan from day one, and you know when it first came out, I rented it from the local video store, and I remember liking it a lot more back then. I think it was before I started my fledgling career as a filmmaker, and I remember liking it a lot more back then than I did upon this initial viewing. This time around, it just felt a little cheaper, you know, a little bit lower budge, but I still enjoy it. I still enjoyed it a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. What about you, John? John?
Yep. I saw it when it originally came out, and I probably rented it from I believe Blockbuster or one of the stores when it originally came out. And I enjoyed it. I think out of the three films, you know, the three Witch House films, it's my favorite one. I do remember it slightly differently, but I thought that there would be more kills in it that I remember. Maybe I'm combining all three together or something, but I still enjoyed it. I thought it was all right. I mean, it was nice seeing the Scream Queens all in there, you know, like the new crop of Scream Queens at that time, you know, kind of this whole kind of new rebirth for Full Moon, you know, with all the digital stuff and Book Walter and Danny Draven, you know, working on it, and Tammy Sutton and stuff. So I still liked it. I still thought it was, you know, the best out of the three.
Definitely. And I agree with you on the idea that, the kills and everything, because if you watch this movie, there are no kills until like maybe more than halfway into the movie. So, you know, there's no the stuff to, it's not like your typical, you know, horror films, you know, and everything. It's you know, crazier. I mean, it's a low budget, as Cameron mentioned, but it's also very I guess character developing, you know, kind of thing. Like, you really get to know the characters a little bit more instead of seeing everybody just die, you know, for pointless deaths. I don't think this is a movie that could be made like today, you know, standards. Like, I feel like people would just, you know, a lot more people would, people would go crazy because there's not that many deaths. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, just fine.
Okay.
I have to agree with you on the death thing. It, you know, some of the deaths, when we do finally get them, they happen off screen. you know, a couple of them, or they're very, I guess you could say, uneventful kind of deaths. They're just not very, it's not a very special effects driven movie. You know, I don't think the real first death happens until like 45, 50 minutes into the film, you know, which you don't need a death every, you know, every 5 minutes or anything. But, you know, I think my favorite one out of the trilogy of Witch House movies is the second one. I really think the second one is really good. I think, but that was also shot on 35 millimeter as opposed to this one, which was shot digitally. I just think it's a very much more slick looking film.
Definitely. Which is weird.
I mean, think that's what most people think. I think most people think part two is the best one.
Which I agree. A lot of people say that, but I for some reason, like this movie, I think it's more of the long lines of the people involved, you know, like, I'm a huge fan of Debra Sean. I'm a huge fan of Tina Krause. I'm a huge fan of Tanya Dempsey. Like, I love all of them, you know, in it and everything. And Brink Stevens playing Lilith, you know, like, I just absolutely adored the cast in this film. And, you know, and J.R. Buchwalter, who directed the film, I thought he did a fantastic job just getting, you know, getting the tension and getting a lot of it, you know, figured out. So I adored this movie a lot more than the other two. Now, the second one was directed by J.R. as well. And the first one isn't like my least favorite. And that's because I just don't like being trapped in one place, you know, so the house, you know, like aspect of it, which it is called Witch House, you know, so I kind of get it, but
it's a little claustrophobic, ain't it?
Right. And I get it. Like, I get what David Dakota did. He did a great job, you know. And I think who was Lilith then? Was it Ariana Albright?
Yes. She played him in played Lilith in part one and part two, I believe.
Yeah. And so it's funny to see Brink Stevens take over. I'm not sure. And I don't want to get into like personal stuff of why, right. You know, because that's not my business.
I think Brink was actually, I mean, I dare say a better Lilith than Ariana was. Not that Ariana was a bad Lilith. She was good, but I'm partial to Brink.
Definitely. So let's talk about the story a little bit. I'm going to read the...
Yeah, me too. Well, there...
Well, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say that there's a great shot of Brink near the end when she's... Well, I don't think it's near the end. It's probably near the middle, where she's in a shower. Like, she's in the shower after one of the girls leaves the shower, and you can kind of see her behind that like frosted glass.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually a really cool shot. And it's kind of creepy and spooky looking, because normally that character would be outside the shower watching somebody in the shower. And now this time they're in the shower watching them, you know, as they're kind of drying off and everything. So yeah, Tina Krause gets out of the shower. And so I think Buchwalter did a good job, you know, with it and everything. And I think one of my reasons for liking it is that Tanya Dempsey is, I had like a major crush on her for a while. And I'm a brunette guy. I mean, I'm not even like a blonde guy. But for some reason, she had it back then. And, you know, so I think I probably watched anything with her in it. So that probably brought it up a notch for me. So.
It's funny. I'm a blonde guy, but I always have had a crush. Like, I love Tina Krause. Like, I think she's adorable and everything. Like, I don't, and like, she's so sweet, you know, in the whole, the movie, you know, like her character's kind of goofy, kind of silly, you know, it's a lot of fun. But I remember, and I'm probably, cause I'm going to be working with her, in a couple weeks, but, I remember, my favorite, like the first movie I ever watched of hers was Quest for the Egg Salad, directed by Chris Seaver. And it is not, it's not one of the ones, like, it's not like her favorite movie, you know?
Oh, Chris Seaver movies.
I know. But there, you know, it was my first foray into, like, you know, knowing who she was. Like, I had known who Debbie was from a little movie called Dead and Rotting. And then I watched the Chris Seaver movies and I saw Quest for the Egg Salad and a bunch of other stuff with Debbie. And that's sort of when I started to fall in love with those kind of, you know, these films, you know, and she's just a remarkable in this film. And so is Debbie. And so is Tanya. Like, everybody just, like I said, and Brink, they all just did exactly what they needed to do, you know?
Right.
Well, they gave they did give it 100%. That is for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you could tell there was no slacking in this, and but when you have on, you know, at the time, I guess that they'd be fairly new, you know, now they're known, but you know, when you got like Danny Draven working and then, you know, Tammy Sutton's behind the scenes and doing like set design and stuff, it was, you know, definitely something that it could have just sucked. And I don't think it did. So, you know, does it hold up today? I'm not necessarily sure, but I still enjoy it. So.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, I think the acting is what shines through in this movie. The girls work really well together. And this is the first movie, at least, that I recall seeing Tanya Dempsey in. And she's just adorable and just so convincing, you know, with the twist that kind of comes along in the end. You know, she plays that off so well.
I know, because like the whole time I guess we could talk about that real quick, but like that right there, that twist, when you finally realize, because you start seeing there's something, you know, whatever, but like I believe her, you know, like that she's like, this is what's really happening, because they give you that fake out of her getting punched or whatever by her boyfriend, which never apparently happened or whatever. But they give you that fake out, which I think is a little, it's always misleading kind of thing. And it's always kind of like they set up so that you know.
It's a bit convoluted, but you know, you can buy it, you know.
Exactly.
Because the whole movie, I had seen this before, I owned it. I haven't watched it in a few years, but it's like, you know, you kind of get caught up in the moment and you're like, you know, in the movie, I'm like, oh, fuck this Burt guy. This Burt guy is a dick. Then I'm just like, oh, wait, no, he really wasn't.
Yeah, even if I hadn't seen it in a while, I forget. I still thought that Burke was an asshole, but he wasn't. And I don't know, like, she was just nuts, you know? Like, but...
Yeah, she was a little cray-cray.
Yeah, so...
But they at least give you, like, a beginning, a middle, and end for that whole thing. So it's not just pointless. You know, they, you know, it's her revenge. So at least they give you all that background, you know, so there is a fair amount of story in this and you know, especially today with you know, not to really get political, but it's, you know, with cancel culture and being woke and all that type of stuff. All people have to do is go back and look at these types of movies. And these are three very strong women that are working together and, you know, they're fighting evil and, you know, the guy gets blamed for something he didn't do and he ended up being a nice guy. So it's one of those things that I think people forget that, you know, the 80s and especially, you know, the like early 90s, you had a lot of these like really strong were just kicking ass and it could be, you know, shooting up a building or fighting a demon or whatever, but it's, you know, it's definitely an empowerment movie, I think.
Totally. So the storyline, it says on IMDb, Annie, a timid young woman in an abusive relationship, flees to the safety of a beach house accompanied by two old friends, Stevie and Rose. The girls hold a seance and unintentionally summon the evil witch Lilith, which I guess is a, you know, fair enough thing. But did they summon the witch or not? You know, like... I don't know. Like,
it's kind of misleading.
Yeah, because like
the synopsis is a little misleading because, like, you know, it's almost like the whole movie is a misdirection. Even the IMDb synopsis is a bit of a misdirection until you get to that like final act.
Well, it's supposed to be because, you know, nobody wants to be spoiled. You know, so if you are being spoiled on the spoilered on the show, then mm-hmm. that's your fault because, you know, you should watch it on Tubi. Instead of like listening to a podcast that's obviously going to be talking about the movie
right.
pretty in depth. I absolutely loved I love the idea, the psychological thriller aspect of it, of like, you know, is she like, because she's the one writing Witches Burn everywhere, you know, and so there's like this like thing of her like, is she like schizophrenic or something? Like she kind of freaks out a little bit. And is she Lilith herself? You know, what do you guys think about that?
I think that she brings Lilith with her. That she definitely brings her into the house. I don't think that she is Lilith, but I think that she brings her there. So, yeah. So the question of do they actually summon her? She might have already been there.
I don't know, though, because there's that scene, the seance scene, and then all of a sudden all the lights start flickering and all this stuff is happening. So I'm just wondering.
Well, if Lilith is already there, she could just do it herself because she's, you know, like a demon. So that's,
yeah, but Stevie was the one who called her name in the movie, right?
But
yeah, it was Stevie, but.
But Tanya Dimpsey's character, though, already had her at her house, you know, had her before she left. What we're not seeing is her going, okay, so these two chicks screwed my boyfriend. I want to go, I'm going to fake that he hit me in the eye. We're going to go over to her house. You're going to screw with them. And, you know, and then you're going to kill everybody. That's kind of what I took. We just didn't see the scene of her going, yeah, we're going to go over there and screw with them. So Lilith could have been hiding in a corner. And as you know, and as Debbie Rochon's character was doing the whole thing, Lilith's like, okay, I've been through this before. Two other movies, obviously. And all right, now I'm going to flick the lights. Now I'm going to turn them off. You know, now I'm going to make the room shake. Okay, boom. Now I'm here when I've always been here. But that's kind of what I got from it. Is right. That it was completely set up.
Oh, right. But my big thing is, okay, so it's never like Tanya was talking. I'm like, unless we did not get this scene or something, a scene like this. It was never because when Tanya Dempsey's character, Annie, comes to the house, she has no idea what's in store for her. Like, she doesn't know why Stevie's dressed up like that. She doesn't know they're doing a witch documentary, unless she does. And we don't know that, you know.
That would be called a plot hole.
Right.
Like, I think she does know. I think she's just playing along. The way it all culminates in the end, when you really find out what's going on, Stevie and Rose had, you know, seduced her man and kind of like, you know, out of jealousy and whatnot. I think she was just playing along, playing the damsel in distress, you know, and that she, you know, what is, you know, Debbie Rochon doing at the beginning of the movie? And let's talk for a moment. I gotta bring this up while I'm thinking about it. What was up with those teeth that Debbie Rochon had in that opening scene in her introduction when she's doing that? Like fangs would have made sense for me. The buck tooth Bubba teeth just didn't quite, I didn't quite know what that was about, but that's getting off subject here.
No, I figured that was a witch thing. I always figured that was a witch thing. I thought that was like witches, a lot of witches have like you've seen the Hocus Pocus, right?
I guess you're right.
Right? Like they always have that kind of weird like buck teeth. Maybe that's what they were going for. I don't know. But like that's the only thing I can imagine because like but like she does that.
But it's also another misdirection too.
Right. You know, there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of misdirection.
I think John said it best. It was a complete misdirection on Tanya's or Annie's part. You know, I think she was just leading them. Everything was about taking one step to the next and leading Rose and Stevie to where she wanted to get them, or where she wanted to get them into Lilith's grasp. She was just playing along with it, you know, playing the victim.
Right, definitely.
I mean, it's kind of like those movies like The Game and some of these other films where I don't like these types of movies for the most part. Like, I'm not a fan of The Game, and I know a lot of people like it. But it's if Michael Douglas went left instead of right, the whole movie would have ended. So with Tanya Dimpsey's character, they have to follow exactly what she's doing because otherwise it wouldn't work. So it's just script stuff. I mean, it's just you have to have somebody go to the beat. You have to have somebody do this. Otherwise, the script won't continue. And so it's just, you know, going to develop plot holes on, you know, unfortunately. So,
yeah, I mean, it is filled with plot holes. But like, I mean, other than me thinking about things and doing this as the show, I don't think like when I first watched it, I never thought about that. You know, I was just like, oh, that's cool. It's Stevie all along, you know, right? Like you're not thinking about the plot holes unless you're really after the movie, you're really like dissecting it. You know what I mean? Like, it's not that glaringly obvious.
I mean, like, what do you think about it in the end?
Well, yeah, there's one scene, and this is...
No, go right ahead, sir. You're good.
Oh, wait. I'll go on, Cameron. I'll go after you.
Oh, no. I was just going to, it's kind of off subject, but like really, the only decent character in this movie, the only like, I guess, semi-virtuous character, I mean, is Rose. I mean, like, even though they did what they did, they seduced, you know, what was the boyfriend's name, Burke. They, you know, they seduced him, but Rick, really, in the end, you know, like, we know what happens with Stevie. She becomes a vessel for Lilith at the end, and Annie was, you know, of course, you know, helping, you know, facilitate the murder of these people. Rose was really the only person in the end that was, like, semi-virtuous. You know, so it's like the misdirection there is that these girls are all kind of evil when really only like one of them was really, you know, a good character.
Definitely.
Right. No, I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I was going to say, it goes back to one thing with the story, and this is kind of deviates a little bit, but it's funny because when you look at these things, you have the scene of Deborah Shawn jogging on the beach near the end where she meets Burke. Mm-hmm. And it's the only scene in the entire movie where I go, I'm not buying this, because she's wearing a tracksuit. She's not wearing like a velour tracksuit. This isn't a jogging suit. Like there's no way that you'd be able to jog in this thing. And she's just jogging and jogging and jogging. And then I noticed she's not wearing a bra and you're jogging. And I would imagine that probably if you talk to any woman, she'd be like, oh yeah, you know, my breasts would be flopping all over. You would wear a bra or at least like a sports bra or something while jogging. And I just thought that scene was really kind of weird, because like, why, especially with the amount of women that worked on this, why wouldn't any of them say, hey, I need a bra, or this kind of looks like I could jog in it, but I can't, you know, it's like, why not just wear sweats with a sweatshirt? So it's kind of a weird thing for me to fixate on, since throughout the whole movie, it doesn't look like really anybody's wearing a bra, but it was just kind of weird to me. Just one of those things that kind of stood out. And I don't know if you guys noticed it or not, but.
Yeah, I noticed that. I thought it was highly impractical. Is it something
would you like me to ask Debbie when I interview her? Like, be like, why were you? Why did that whole like thing happen? You know, like,
I'm sure the answer is going to be, at least for the velour track suit that she was wearing, that was her own wardrobe. That's what she brought. And then it's like, that's what you brought. That's what you had. The budget didn't allow her to have another outfit, I'm sure. That for all the budget, you know, indie filmmakers, you know how it works. If you're an actor, most of the time you bring your own wardrobe. And if it doesn't work out, then that's just the way it is.
Are you kidding me? You don't have a wardrobe? No. See, okay. So that's so funny, because like I've been doing these like Lifetime movies and everything, and I love them. I've loved working on them and everything, but I always thought, oh, it's Hollywood. It's Lifetime. They're going to have like their own wardrobe people. That's going to, you know, whatever. And no, they were like, bring your own wardrobe. You know, we'll pick. that's the costume person is like, we'll pick which ones we want. And then, I happen to have like, you know, a few choices, but not like they ended up having like four scenes that they were going to do with me. So I was like, all right, you know, I didn't bring enough because I didn't know I was doing that many, you know, that I was just doing like one or two scenes. And so they actually had to give me wardrobe. And that was the first time. No, other than the asylum set that I was on, the asylum gave me my own wardrobe, but those are army fatigues. So like, I, you know, I don't think they were expecting me to bring those. You know, like
that surprises me. Of all the shoots, that Asylum was the one that's like, we got your wardrobe.
Oh, they do. Oh man, I'm gonna say this. They have this amazing wardrobe lady who like has like a lot of stuff. So they're good. Like, which I was surprised too. I was like, I didn't know what to expect at all. And real quick before we get back to Witchhouse 3, when I got there, I didn't know who I was playing like or whatever. Like, I was just kind of told, do you want to act in this thing? I thought I was doing extra, you know, or whatever. So I was like, I looked down and I see like Richards, you know, and I'm like, oh, I've got a name. And they're like, yeah, you've got lines too. And I'm like, I do. I had a lot of lines that I had to like figure out how to memorize and like, you know, in less than an hour. you know.
Oh, I'd have been in so much trouble.
Yeah. And see, hey, I think I felt like there was a couple times, and I watched this when I watched this Witch House 3 movie, that there was a couple times that people stumbled a little bit, maybe. Like there's a couple, you know, like they didn't say the words exactly, like kind of messed up a little bit. But other than that, there was really no, you know, no bad delivery of any of these lines, you know, or anything. You know, I thought they did a great job, you know, delivering the dialogue.
All of them did a really great job. I thought probably the weakest character was, I don't remember the actor's name that plays Burke. He was probably the weakest of the bunch. And of course, Debbie Rochon. Nobody curses like Debbie Rochon. You let her throw around the F-bomb and whatnot, you got cinematic gold.
Yeah. I thought you were going to go somewhere different with that, because you were like, the weakest person was Burke, and then Debbie Rochon. And I was like, wait, what? Debbie Rochon is definitely not weak in this movie. I thought this was one of my favorites that she's ever done. You know, like honestly, like, because she normally plays, she doesn't play the lead, she plays like supporting characters mostly, you know, like leads in occasional movies, but she was supporting in this, or she was lead in this, you know, and I thought she did, like, I mean, she. And that was the other thing, is I thought it was going to be, the lead was going to be Tanya Dempsey's character. I thought she was the lead until I watched the movie more and more and realized, like, Debbie is the lead of this movie. Like, she's the, you know, she's sort of the heroine, you know, of the movie.
Well, it's kind of a little bit of a bait and switch, you know, the way they introduce the characters at the beginning, you think it's going to be Annie, you know, right. Tanya Dempsey's character is going to be the lead, and there's that. There's kind of a tonal shift as the movie slowly progresses, you know what I mean? And it's Debbie all the way.
Definitely. Would you agree, John?
Slightly, kind of. I still think Annie would be a lead, but then that's Tanya Dempsey, right? Is Annie? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Debbie Rochon would kind of be like a surrogate on there, because it does begin with Tanya Dempsey, and it ends with Tanya Dempsey, and it is her story of revenge. And but I would say that, Debbie Rochon, you know, kind of steals it, almost kind of making her like the lead.
Definitely. Yeah. I would say that too. Like, it's funny to say that, like, it's funny to say that Debbie steals a movie, you know what I mean? Because like, she sort of, I mean, I feel like she does, even when she's a supporting character, you know, like,
she steals
scenes in like Romeo and Juliet, you know, like all these different movies that she's been in. She always steals, like, you know, everybody just absolutely adores her, you know, as an actress, and everything she does. And that says a lot, like, you know, because she has to constantly be making lots and lots of movies, right? Like, she's always, it's funny, we're doing this and then we're doing another Debbie Rochon movie for my next one. I'm not gonna say what it is yet. Usually I don't tell people until later, you know, what the movie is gonna be, but we're gonna do another one and I haven't even seen it, but I know she's in it. And I'm like she does so much, you know what I mean? Like, she's constantly in, like, I don't know how many movies, just like Brink, you know, Brink's in, like, I think almost 300 or so, like, films. That's a lot, you know?
I mean, they're always constantly working, and, you know, and good for them. You know, some of these, you know, indie actors and actresses, you know, like, that with films that we've all worked on, you know, they do a few films and they're kind of not like necessarily a one and done, but they do a handful of films and they move on. Brink and Debbie, God, you know, they've been around for years and always constantly working, putting out, you know, film after film.
Another person is like Tiffany Shepis does that. Felissa Rose. I mean, these actresses are out there busting their ass and everything. And it's so nice to see Debbie and Tina, and because I know Debbie and Tina have to have been friends. Like, they have to have known each other through different circles. I don't know if they've ever worked together in a film, like in the same scene or anything, you know, but I mean, that's just amazing to me.
It says something about their longevity, you know, not just like in the business, but like with their fans. you know, because, you know, people love them, and rightly so, because they're both amazing. I love Debbie, and I love Brink. I mean, I worked with Brink on the first movie I ever made, you know, and I think that was
really
why. Yeah.
I didn't know. Okay, so you worked with her on PMA?
No. That was the first movie I directed, but I worked with her on It Came From Trafalgar, which was the first movie that I like ever worked on behind the scenes. And I had a couple of scenes with her. I played an alien that I attack her in one scene, you know, but she's great. And I think really that's the one thing that is a negative about this movie, and not saying that the movie is bad, but it was too little Brink. It's a little bit too little of Lilith. I could have used more Lilith, you know. It's kind of like going to see the Lilith character is not as prolific as like a Freddy Krueger, but it's like going to see a Freddy Krueger movie, and the first time you really see Freddy, it's 45 minutes in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's this movie, I think I made it in one of my notes here, was like 51 minutes in, and we get our first real scene that's not just kind of a ghostly shot of Lilith kind of walking around or in a shadow in the background. It's 51 minutes in before you get your first real meaty scene with her, which is just kind of disappointing. I love Brink, and I would just like to see more of her.
Yeah. You don't really see her. Go ahead, John.
Oh no, I was going to say to kind of go back to something that you guys were saying with these Scream Queens is, you know, what really makes a Scream Queen, and is it that they're nice to work with, or they work a lot, or they're good actresses, or they'll do nude scenes, or because you get so many people, including today, that just go, oh, I made one movie where I showed my boobs and now I'm a Scream Queen. So that's the title that's with them always. It's, you know, Susan Berg, Scream Queen. It's like, I've never heard of you. I've never seen one movie you've done. And just because you take off your clothes in one film doesn't make you a Scream Queen. And that's what makes, you know, a lot of these women not Scream Queens. And there's that small little group of the, you know, Linnea Quigley is in the Brink Stevens and the Debbie Rochons, and that still are Scream Queens, and that, you know, got that, you know, through our trust and through hard work and giving us good product. So it's kind of so it was nice seeing them all together. I do agree that it would have been nice to see more Lilith. You know, I worked with Brink myself on Meat Hook 4, and she was great to work with. You know, we had her for like 2 days, and I would definitely work with her again. So yeah, it would have been nice to see more of her, but it was also great seeing the other girls too, just, you know, together.
Right. Yeah. And you said, Cameron, like you said, 51 minutes in was like the big reveal, like big thing where you saw her more. And I believe, if I'm correct, and I don't know if you wrote it in your notes, but I think the 51 pages was when Tina was in bed and and Brink, you know, comes to her, Lilith mm-hmm. comes to her yeah. in the bed, and she's like freaking out, like, who the hell are you? You know, like, what are you doing? And, you know, what are you doing here? Whatever. Right. And she runs off.
Nobody believes her.
Nobody believes her.
Poor Tina.
Yeah, poor Tina, poor Rose. She got kind of shafted on that, you know, but it sort of worked out that, like, you know, you got to see it. You got to finally see Lilith. And I wish there was more of her. But then again, I don't think the movie... I think Witch House 3, Demon Fire, was trying its hardest to not make it be all about Lilith. You know, this was about the women. This was about, because like the first two movies are all about Lilith, right? This is like Witch House 1 is, it's like you're in Lilith's house. You know, this one, they're in a beach house. They're not even in the same house that Lilith was in, you know? And like, so. You know, I want to go back to what we were talking about earlier with the kind of the big twist and the big reveal and everything. I still wish that we would have gotten a scene with her summoning Lilith, you know, like her actually summoning Lilith, like a flashback or something, you know, and maybe that just wasn't in the cards, or they maybe had the idea for it, but they couldn't do it, you know, kind of thing. You never know with these movies. I mean, it was already like over an hour and a half long, you know, which is
long for a full moon movie. Most of their movies run like the 75 minute mark, you know, or
right.
Less.
Yeah.
Maybe it just wasn't wrote in the script.
Right. Maybe they just didn't write in the script, But I would have loved to see that. Like, I would have loved to see her summoning the spirit so the spirit would be there. So we could have gotten to understand, like, exactly what's going on, because, you know, it kind of leaves a little bit questioning, but sometimes that's not good because then the audience is confused, you know, in my mind, you know? Yeah, so
I can see that. I would have liked to have seen that scene too, because, again, it would have given us
more brick. More love. Yeah, which would have been great, but so it was wonderful, like what it was. This film itself was a lot of fun. What did you guys think of, like, I really liked the score in this movie. What did you guys think of the music?
I like the score. Some of the tracks were lifted from Pit and the Pendulum. I remember reading that in some of the IMDb trivia and whatnot, because I thought it sounded familiar. I like the score. What I did not like, however, was the songs that accompanied it, the actual, like, songs. I think it was done, some of them were done by Midnight Syndicate and another group. I didn't care much for those, but, like, the score, the overall ambient music was really, really good. That's always been a strong suit in Full Moon movies.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised Richard Band didn't do the music, you know, itself, you know, himself, but maybe some of his...
Well, if it's lifted from Pit and the Pendulum, he did.
Yeah,
right.
He wasn't credited. That's the thing. So I'm wondering about that. But yeah,
I do agree with Cameron, though. I enjoyed the score. So all the instrumental stuff I thought was fine. It was pretty good. Mm-hmm. And then, but the songs themselves could have just had one at the end during the credits. I think that would have been fine. You know, and kind of have their song, and that would have been okay. But the vocals kind of popped out of nowhere in some of the scenes. Like, oh, okay, now we have a song. You know, it's just not the score anymore, and it seemed a little out of place here and there. But they weren't horrible, but I could have just lived with a nice score instead.
Same.
I do want to also mention that Matthew Jason Walsh wrote this one, co-wrote it with Jared Bookwalter, but he also was the writer of the original Witch House, but I don't believe he did Witch House 2. I think just Jared Bookwalter did it. So I think it's really nice that he came back to kind of help, you know, because they worked together since, I mean, I think Jared Bookwalter, like, discovered, you know, Matthew Jason Walsh, who I'm a huge fan of. I was doing a project years ago, and Cameron probably knows more about this too, because we've known each other for, like, since what, 2008 or seven or something, when I was MySpace when I was working.
At least then. Oh yeah. MySpace. Oh,
yeah. So we were working on a project. I'm not going to say what it was or whatever, but I was working on a project and had a character named Matthew, and I had another character named Jason. Both the last name was Walsh, right? But they weren't related. You know, that was the whole point, was that they're no relation, but they're cops who both had the same last name and everything.
Well, I think I know what project you're talking about.
Yeah. And I let somebody know about that worked with James. So James actually sent that to Matthew, and that's how me and Matthew became friends, you know, or whatever, like, knew each other, you know. And once again, it was from MySpace days. Now I think Matthew keeps off the radar. He still works with David Dakota in a lot of the Lifetime movies and stuff, but they don't really, you know. Now, if they were to make a Witch House 4, I'd be okay with that. Like, I would love for them to bring that back, you know. Like,
I would love for them to revisit Witch House.
I would not want a remake. I would not want a remake. And I know like, that seems to be what a lot of people do these days, is do a reboot or whatever of it, because, like, people might forget what Witch House is. No, don't do that. Just make a sequel, you know, or whatever, because it would, if JR ever wanted to do that, you know, I know he's not planning to do any, like, you know, sequels, reboots right now, but if he ever does, you know, I want dabs on that one. I want dibs on that one. You know?
Yeah, like, I'm a sequel guy. I enjoy sequels. I am not so much a fan of remakes. There's the occasional one, you know, reboots and remakes that I don't mind, that are okay. But I'm more of a sequel type guy. Just continue the story and build upon that. And I'm all for it.
What do you think, John? Would you want a sequel to Witch House? Another one?
I think if Charles Band did, what is it? His... What's the six filmmakers?
No, it's 10.
And then
10.
They're all taking on, like, a sequel. Like the 10 filmmakers, yeah, you could do another Witch House, like Witch House 4 in that kind of thing. So why not? I mean, it's if you're going to make another Puppet Master film and you're going to do all that, sure, why not? So and to kind of, you know, go along with what Cameron said, I've gotten over the whole remake thing. So to me, a remake is almost a good thing, because then that brings more attention to the original, and you're always going to get that awesome like DVD or Blu-ray of the original, where you wouldn't get if they didn't do, you know, a remake of it. So I would probably be more up for, depending on what it is, a remake, just to get that kick-ass Blu-ray. But of course, the sequel is always good too. There's way too many. Fuck, I just got done watching Terminator Dark Fate, and that's a whole other podcast. But you know, we really need to. We really need to stop these types of things. But it's I can see a Witchcraft 4, sure. Why not? Because all the actresses are still there. If you wanted to bring back some from all three movies, you could.
Yeah.
Especially the third one.
Yeah. And then, you know, you could put them as different characters, because a lot of them are older now. Like, they might not even look exactly the same anyway or whatever. And people don't care. You know, like the fans want, I believe like the fans will want to see this, you know, will want to see that. As far as remakes go, I agree with you, John, on that, like that it does, because if it weren't for the horrible Karate Kid remake that we had, we probably never would have gotten Cobra Kai. Exactly. So there you go. You know,
that film shall never be discussed or enter my collection of my favorite series of all time. So that film will never be discussed. And I am happy that the creators of Cobra Kai have said that it is a multiverse film, and that Jaden will never show up on Cobra Kai. So,
yeah, exactly. Yes. Well, it's funny because a lot of the producers of that one, because they have the rights or whatever, are producers for the Cobra Kai series. So it's sort of like a little weird. But you know what? We're probably going to get into that someday on a Hollywood Boulevard podcast. So let's wait on that, John. Like that discussion. That's a whole different.
Oh yeah, because I have plenty to say about the whole Smith clan and Jaden Smith and the remake of the Chinese Kid, since they're not doing karate in the movie. Assholes couldn't even change the friggin' title of the remake. Jackie,
Kung Fu.
They weren't doing Kung Fu. No, he. So it's I'm sorry. Yeah, Kung Fu Kid. He wasn't doing karate. He was doing Kung Fu.
Right.
But the producer just didn't want to change the titles. So it's just a clusterfuck from beginning to end.
Because everybody knows what Karate Kid was. Anyway, this is not about Karate Kid. This is about Witch House 3. So I'm going to bring it back to that. Usually in my podcast, we go different on tangents that go on different like little things.
On mine too. Sometimes we, get off subject a little bit.
Especially if you have Dustin on there. That happens a lot. I love Dustin, but he tends to go a little tangents on how he feels on things. So it's really funny.
I do too. One time we did a show on Maniac and we went off on a tangent for 20 minutes about Halloween and how cute PJ Souls was, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but you know, sometimes you get off subject.
Right, exactly. So you okay, so we talked about this earlier. So Cameron, your favorite one was part two, was that right?
Yes, part two, Blood Coven. Yes.
Okay, and John, what was your favorite one?
It'd be part three.
Part three. Wow, I'm surprised nobody me and John agree on part three. You say two, but nobody had said one. And like a lot of people, I mean, that was the one that started it all. But like, I do feel like, and I hate to say it because I love David Dakota and watch all his movies, you know, or whatever. I'll always be a fan of his. He made that movie, you know what I mean? Like that's a David Dakota film, you know? So it's always kind of surprising when people are not as into it, you know, or whatever, as they are into the other ones. Yeah.
I mean, if I had
to, you know, he just didn't have enough of men with their shirts off in it. That's why it's not the best one.
Okay.
I don't know. If I had to rate them, I would probably rate them 2, 1, and then 3.
Oh, and for real?
Yeah, and it's just because by process of elimination, one of them has to be your least favorite. And I still like all three, you know, but by process of elimination, I got to go 2, 1, then 3.
Sorry. I would probably go 3, 2, 1. And what I really liked about 2 was, like, I think the 2 had the thing that you guys were talking about earlier, which was more deaths, you know, in 2 than they did even in 1 or 3, you know? Like, that had the most deaths, I feel like. But I feel like this was a lower budget. Like, they couldn't afford to do more deaths and stuff.
Well, the budget for this one was only, I think I read that it was like 25 or 26,000, which, you know, is still astronomical when you, you know, think about it from my standpoint of the kind of the level of movies that I've made, you know, but,
and that's
26,000, you know, isn't a whole lot of money when you're thinking in full moon terms.
Well, that's even earlier. That's, well, yeah, that's early 2000s too. That's, so that's more money than it would be today, you know, or whatever. Yeah. So their budget, I mean, that would be a bigger budget. Like, that's surprising because, like, full moon now, I hate to say it, but they tend to make things like 20 grand or less, you know, like they try to and I want to emphasize on the less, you know, because, like, they really try to make as many, because they don't have the and you know this a lot, Cameron, because you probably talk about, since you talk about full moon all the time or whatever, but, like, back in the day, they had, like, money from, I think it was Paramount, who was funding.
Yeah, they had the Paramount money.
Yeah, Paramount, yeah.
And now they have, like,
Paramount's paying.
But then they got weird, though. But they got really strange with everything. Like Charles Band, I don't know if it was ego or what, but they had that steady stream of those hits. And then he started doing those weird sequels to sequels all at once. Like, there was Puppet Master 4 and 5 and Pre-Hysteria 2 and 3 and Trancers 4 and 5, where he was, like, taking the budget for one movie and splicing them into 2, and then having all of them based at the castle in Romania. And then he got into the whole digital thing. And it seemed like since this whole thing happened, Full Moon has not been the same. Mm-hmm. And it I don't think it's definitely the same since, you know, probably for about the last 10 or 15 years that, I mean, it's, you know, as much as I love Full Moon and, you know, and I got the opportunity to work on Evil Bong 777 and I wouldn't have passed that up for the world. It's no Trancers. I mean, it's no Subspecies. It's no, you know, Puppet Master 3. You know, it's something has changed over the years with this, where Full Moon is not the same company it's to be. And it's kind of a shame because they were bringing out some really good stuff. Even if it did mimic some of the bigger movies, it was still pretty good. And even some of their bad stuff, like, let's say, you know, like Seed People, I wasn't a big fan of because it's just Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but it's still a lot better than some of the other stuff that other companies were making. They just haven't regained that yet. And it's just kind of strange how they're now just a different company. So if they did do, like, a Witch House 4, I'd be curious to see what it would be like a, you know, a 2 or 3 day shoot, and maybe Charles Band would direct it, and it would have all the same usual suspects that are now on all their movies.
Definitely. Cameron, were you going to say something?
Oh, I was going to mention one movie that they had that does kind of rekindle some of that old school feel, that old school full moon feeling. I'm getting off subject of Witch House here for just a moment, is Ouija's. Uh-huh. Ouija's was a fun movie. It had that certain pizzazz and that certain feel from the old Paramount days. You know, it felt more like the Charles Band in Full Moon of old. I don't know if either one of you have watched it, but it has a very Gremlins, Ghoulies, you know, type of vibe, like critters all kind of rolled into one. If that's an indication of where they're going, hopefully, with these last few movies they've made, I hope that's a continuing trend, because Ouija's was brilliant.
And I just read, I looked it up because I saw some of it. I didn't get to watch the whole thing, but I really, like, I was enjoying it, you know. It was just like I was watching it on my phone instead of watching it on a, you know, on a big screen TV. So I was like, I can't watch this on my phone. Like, this needs a television. I just never got around to it. But Danny Draven directed it. And Danny is one of those people I'm very happy is still in the Full Moon world, you know. Like, I know I'm doing 31 days of indie horror, and one of the films I had picked for it, I have not picked somebody to do it yet, but one of the people or one of the things I was going to do was for that for it was Deathbed, because I fucking love that movie. Like, I absolutely think that movie is just so. And I think Tanya Dempsey in that movie. I think so. I'm correct.
I have not seen that. I've heard good things about it, but I have not seen Deathbed yet.
It is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I own it, and I haven't even watched it yet.
It is. Yep, Tanya Dempsey's in it.
But I. Yeah, yeah, she is. And I will say this, because this is kind of Witch House related, since Danny Draven worked on the film. He's a really nice guy. And I agree with you, Jonathan, when you say that you're happy to see that he's still out there. When I was on, you know, Evil Bong, and I saw him on set, I'm just like, oh, crap, that's Danny Draven. Yeah. And I went over and I introduced myself. And this was in between takes, so we could talk for a little bit. And I just chatted him up, and he answered every question that I had. And he asked if I owned his movies, and I told him which ones. And he thought it was, you know, really funny that I thought Horror Vision was it's my favorite film by him. I still like it a lot. And the next day on set, all of a sudden he comes in holding this big bag of stuff, and aww, he just hands me CDs and DVDs, and he signed all of them. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, dude, you know, thanks for being a fan. Here you go. You know, nice to meet you. And I'm just like, wow. And we shot for, I want to say, 4 days. And every day I struck up conversations with him, or a couple times I was really surprised, you know, this is Danny Draven tapping on my shoulder saying, hey man, what's up? How you doing? So, you know, he's a really nice guy. And yeah, and it's great to see that he's still, you know, making movies with Full Moon and, you know, and outside of that. So I only have good things to say about the guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love Danny Draven. I love Horror Vision too. That's a great film. Good. Like tech movie. Yeah. Good tech horror movie.
And yeah, he was almost embarrassed about that when I told him that, because he was probably expecting something totally different. And, you know, and then I brought it in. I brought in some movies for him to sign. Some he brought in the more updated versions of them, like the covers and stuff like that. And I have like the very first, you know, like that first run of Horror Vision. And he's like, man, this is really old. You know, you sure you want me to sign this? And I'm like, yeah, it's classic. Of course, that's what I want you to sign.
Yeah, I have that same one, the Lunar Edition.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have that signed by Brink.
Nice.
Oh, nice.
Well, fellas, we are at that time now. We've talked Witch House 3 for almost an hour, and we're at the time where we're going to give our rating to it. So, but wow, this has been a great discussion. I think we've all kind of had almost a different take on it a little bit, you know, or at least our thoughts and everything. So, that's great. So to begin with, I we like to explain the stinkometer so that people who
I love that, by the way, stinkometer.
That was Paul's. That was Paul's thing. I originally didn't want it, honestly, because I don't want.
It's people not the moo-ometer.
Yeah, that's no. But he wanted to do something because, you know, he likes stinky movies, you know, like he likes, you know, bad movies or whatever, you know, as long as they're fun, bad movies, you know, and everything. But I'm one of those people that don't like to just give like really bad movies all the time. You know, I like to kind of like, you know, put something in there good or whatever, you know, that I can. And so I'm glad I picked this one because I really enjoyed it, you know, honestly. So the stinkometer is a rating from 1 to 10, one being really good, excellent kind of movie, the best, you know, or whatever. I don't even know if you've ever had a one, you know, yet. You like one, you know, that would be technically a three, you know, because you can't go lower than a one. Maybe you could go a half, you know, but we do and then you can do a half. So you can do 1 to 10, and you could do like 5.5 if you feel like you know, it's close to something or whatever, but not quite there. So 10 being the stinkiest bad movie, you know, that you can think of, and then 1 being really good. So I always let my guests go first. So which one wants to start it off?
Doesn't matter to me.
Oh, you go, Cameron.
Okay, so do we just do a skip?
I'll go second.
10 being the stinkiest and 1 being the best. I have to say, I give this movie, it's a middle of the road for me. I have to give it a 5. It's nowhere near the stinkiest, but it's nowhere near the best of the series. I don't know what I would rate the other two. I'd have to rewatch them because I haven't watched them in such a long time. But, you know, there's some musical choices, you know, that's a turnoff for me. Music is a big thing for me. If you have songs that are playing over the soundtrack with really loud lyrics, and if the lyrics in the songs don't match up with the overall thematic qualities of the movie, it's an automatic turnoff for me. And right. It does suffer from too little Lilith. I'm here for Lilith, you know, whether it's Ariana playing her or Brink playing her. So I got to give it a 5. It's Midland stinky.
All right. Well, there you go. That's fair. What about you, John?
I think I have to preface this by saying that my review is directly aimed at something that Full Moon would make. So if this was a star rating and I gave it 3 stars, there is in no way that this is as good as, you know, I don't, Mad Max or something like that. So if it was a star rating, it'd be a 3. So I guess what on a 10 being the worst, 1 being the best scale, what that would be like a 3?
I guess that's fair.
2 or 3, somewhere right in there. I mean, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it enough. I'm going to give it a 3 because it does have its plot holes. And I understand it's Full Moon and it's a short, low budget movie and stuff like that. But yeah, there are some things that could have been explained a little bit more, like you had even mentioned, like maybe certain scenes could have been done to explain things a little further. Maybe they didn't have the budget or the script or whatever. But yeah, I'm going to say 3.
It's funny that you say 3. I'm actually going to give it a 4. And that's pretty low for me, you know, like, you know, doing the show. I love it. Like, really, I do. Like, I adore this movie. I could watch this movie more than once, you know, like in months, you know, apart from each other, you know, that kind of thing. Like, actually, I did sort of watched it a bit. Like, I only got about 45 minutes in before, and then just things like life happened, so I couldn't finish it. So I went back and I restarted it from the very beginning today, so that I could, you know, be fresh in my mind. It can make sure, you know, everything. And I like it. It's one of those movies that, like, the time just goes by like this, you know, and everything. And I really enjoy it. But it's, you know, it's a fun movie. It's got my biggest plot hole issues was this, the like non-explaining of all that stuff, and that just kind of, you know, hurts it a little bit. But aside from that, the acting is amazing. The direction is well done. The cinematography by Danny Draven is just fantastic, you know, like for this kind of movie.
There's some really great shots in it. It is really well shot for such a little
movie. Yeah.
It really is.
And so that Danny did the DPing of this is just amazing, you know, like that just shows what a versatile like person he is, a talented individual. And as you said, now I know he's really, really nice. I've never met him, so I'm, you know, I won't be as timid to meet him now, you know. Maybe I should be, I don't know. But, you know, maybe he'll treat me differently than you, I don't know. But I doubt it. But anyway, let's hope not. But that's pretty much it, though. Well, at this time we always ask what our guests are up to. So Cameron, since you've never been on the show before and everything, what have you been up to?
Well, I actually just got back from Tallahassee, Florida. I was shooting a film down there for Lost Bastards Productions. We shot a movie called Cruel Summer. I was acting in it. I was doing the catering for it. I was doing production assistant. I was doing a little bit of everything. So I just
As you do on an indie set, right? Like,
yeah. I was running lights. I helped run sound. I shot behind the scenes. I drove people around. You know, did a little bit of everything, acted, you know how it is. You got to wear 18 different hats, but I just finished that. I'm working on my podcast, Cinema Degeneration. We got a couple of shows that we do on there, a couple called, Grindhouse Pizzeria. And then we got our Full Moon show, Howling at the Full Moon, where we do everything and anything related to Charles Band from the Empire days to present day. And we've got a couple other new shows, got a new one that's actually just getting ready to drop next week called Sequel 2 Deja Vu, where we strictly just do sequels. We don't do the first movie in a series, and we specifically do them out of sequence. So we'll do like I can let this go on here because it'll come out about the same time, but their first show will be on Psycho 2. And, nice. You know, so we just, I got a lot of love for a lot of sequels, so I wanted to do that. And I actually got a couple of short films that I just finished. My wife is actually editing them for me. She's quite the editor. And they're going to be part of a kind of a semi-top secret anthology that I can't, like, reveal the name of right now. But they should be released, I think it's late July or early August. So that's pretty much been keeping me pretty busy these days.
Yeah. So, wow. And like I said before, the main reason I had you come, you know, had you come on the show and why I picked Witch House 3 for our first, you know, for your first time in here is because you do the Howling at the Full Moon. And I figured this is kind of a cool thing. I don't know if you'll ever get to the Witch House series on your show or not, or if it might be a while before you do it. So figured, you know, it'd be kind of a fun little show for you to do.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a good stepping off point for me to come onto your show. It seemed pretty appropriate because when you asked me to do it, I'm like, yeah, it's a full moon movie. And we usually do them in sequence. So, you know, like I would do part one and then two and three. And so by the time we get to part three on our show, it'll probably be a ways away.
I do believe this is the first time if we've done a sequel, this is the, I don't think we've done a sequel yet on Indie Film Cafe. So this may be a first. But if we have it, we've never done like, we usually do like the first one first, then do a, you know, like that.
That's how I do them too.
Yeah.
Kind of do them in sequence, except on that new show, because I just got a wild hair up my butt and decided I just wanted to do nothing but strictly sequels, good ones and bad ones.
Nice. What about you, John? What have you been up to?
Let's see. So got Axemas 3 and 4 in the works. Going to be shooting a short film for Phil Herman's anthology called Delete. Working on my own anthology called Reign of Vibrant Screams, which is a cosmic horror anthology. So putting that together, hopefully that will be coming out in October or November. And then I have my own show, which I believe I shoot the first episode this coming Wednesday, called One Maker, One Film, where we talk to one filmmaker about one film that they made from beginning to end. So that's pretty much what I'm doing these days.
Yeah, you said it's like, I guess, I don't know if like you want this out there or whatever, but it's kind of like a thing where you talk from, like you say beginning to end, but you say like how they started all the way to like post-production kind of thing, right? Like, you know, you dive into it, right?
Yeah. Very detailed on when did you come up with the idea? How did you come up, you know, when did you come up with it? How did you come up with it? What did you do to make it happen? Discuss in detail, you know, pre-production, production, post-production, talk about distribution, talk about financing. You know, what are some positives that came from it? What are some negatives? All that type of stuff, kind of like a little film school on just that movie. In however long it takes that filmmaker to discuss it. And then if that filmmaker wants to come back, let's say later on, they could discuss another film that they did. It can be a sequel or it could be a brand new film that they're doing or whatever, but it's just going to be based on just one movie in particular, instead of talking about like 20 movies.
Awesome. Well, that's great. I mean, I love that. We're all doing our own like different podcasts and it's all like film related, you know, generally. So I think that's great. That's mainly what I listen to. You know, I listen to those stuff like interviews or reviews or whatever, you know, what have you. So I absolutely adore this. Thank you guys.
Thank you.
Oh,
thank you.
And here on Indie Film Cafe, we've got a bunch of stuff going on. But Sick Flick Productions, my company, is actually going to be shooting two short films in 2 weeks from today, basically, like yesterday, which would have been a Friday. We're doing two short films back to back, one starring Tina Krause. So that was one of the reasons why I wanted to have this show so I could talk to her about that. I think we're also going to try to get an interview with her as well for Indie Film Cafe Spotlight. So nice. It's going to be a busy time. And then we're also going to be, I've got a ton of podcasts and vidcasts going on, like for YouTube. I mean, you know, it's not going to stop. You know, I'm doing like one podcast at least, if not two, a day for like from now on, like until later. So,
oh, wow. Busy is yeah, good.
Yeah, I'm trying to keep busy because right now I don't have, other than prepping, you know, for the movie and everything, I don't really have a lot of stuff to do, you know, so why not? I mean, it only takes about an hour or two to do these podcasts. Why not? You know, and plus I get to watch movies. Like, how fucking cool is that?
Yeah, you know? I mean, but do we really need an excuse to watch movies? I know I don't, but I love having one.
Right. I don't need an excuse. I watch movies all the time. But like, I'm really excited because like, I don't know how much I'm going to work tomorrow, but like my plan tomorrow, a lot of it is to watch a bunch of the movies that I have to review coming up. So I'm going to be watching back-to-back movies, you know? And to me, that's kind of like, I get jealous when Paul does that, you know, with his friends, you know, and everything. So there you go. But thank you guys. Please check in next week, or not next week, 2 weeks. There'll be Paul's pick. And so that's going to be fun. I'm wondering if we'll be doing that on the set or something, you know, like that's how a lot of these things get done, is just, you know, if we're together, let's do one, you know, let's do a podcast.
Why not?
Yeah. Right. Why not? Right. Yeah, exactly. So I really love that. Check out all the stuff that we're going. So go to sickflickproductions.com, indiefilmcafe.podbean.com, which is where you can find this. indiefilmcafe.reviews and patreon.com/indiefilmcafe if you want to throw in a buck and help us out. There's going to be Patreon only podcasts and other stuff that we're going to be doing. We're going to be doing a lot more as soon as things kind of settle down with us shooting and everything. We're definitely going to be also, we're going to be shooting this summer most likely too, so it's going to be a busy year. We got to make up for last year.
Everybody does.
Oh yeah,
I know.
Oh yeah,
that's what's going on right now in the world. Appreciate everybody check this out, and if you guys could stay on after, that'd be great. But thank you guys, have a good one everybody. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.